Talking History. On News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the story of the women who fought to win the right to vote, how silver has shaped the histories and economies of the world, the Nazi prisoners who were transported across Europe to be used as hostages, oral histories of the black and tans, and finally, to end the show, we'll explore how Vermeer created his masterpieces. But first, why they marched. Untold stories of the women who fought for the right to vote. Looking beyond the national leadership of the suffrage movement, an acclaimed historian gives voice to the thousands of women from different backgrounds, races and religions whose local passion and protest resounded throughout the United States. The book is called Why They Marched, Untold Stories of the Women Who Fought for the Right to Vote. It's published in hardback by Harvard University Press and costs £19.95, so about €23. The author is Susan Ware. And Susan, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can we begin with a question about women's suffrage itself? Because it was always bigger than just getting the vote, wasn't it?
Yes, because when you think about it, it's a seemingly straightforward political goal. But the fact that women didn't have the vote was linked to all kinds of other attitudes about women's place in society, their roles as wives and mothers. And in order to convince the polity to give women the vote, it was important to make the point that women deserve the vote and that they were equal citizens with men. And so I always see it as just an entry into a much larger discussion about what roles women should play in public life. And yet, not having the vote, certainly by the early 20th century, was a real affront to many women because they were playing large roles in the professions and in work and in their homes, and they couldn't vote. And I think that that disconnect was one of the things that really drove the passion that they brought to getting themselves to the polls.
Can we talk about some of the women you cover in the book? Because it's an extraordinary range of activists, and you have different classes, you have different backgrounds, different races, different religions. And by looking at them, you get insights into the different kinds of campaigns that were waged.
Well, I think one of the things that I've learned in my years as a historian is that biography is often a perfect way to make history come alive, because when you can tell stories about individual people, then what you can do is, instead of just having some bland, lifeless story of national organizations and national leaders, you have real people, in this case real women, who are doing things that they never would have thought possible in order to be part of this large political movement for the vote. So that for me, one of the things I was trying to do was to capture the range of women who were involved. And I very consciously tried to think about women from different regions of the United States, because in this country, most of the history that gets written tends to be of the eastern United States, especially New York. So I wanted to make sure that we headed out west. I certainly wanted to not just have white middle-class women. So we have working-class women, African-American women. And the idea was really to just broaden the story and also to remind people that the way social movements happen is on the ground. It's with people. It's with people deciding that they are going to sign on to the cause. And again, for me, the way to make that come alive was by telling individual stories.
So let's talk about some of these people then and tell their stories. I was intrigued by the story of Emmeline W. Wells.
Yes, well, Emmeline Wells is an interesting character because she's a very strong suffragist. She's an editor of a nationally known newspaper, but she's also a Mormon polygamous wife. And she's a voter, because Utah women were among the earliest women in the United States to get the vote. And so her story is fascinating one because it shows how a seemingly straightforward question like votes for women got tied up in what was probably one of the most controversial political, legal, and moral questions of the 19th century, which was the role of polygamy and the state and the Mormon Church. And it did cause some complications for the suffrage movement because some of the suffrage movement leaders said, hey, great, these Utah women are voters. We welcome them to the movement. And others said, oh, no, we're staying as far away as possible from the issue, the hot-button issue of polygamy. And yet, what I was most impressed by was the commitment that these Mormon women brought to the cause. They were as avid suffragists, and they believed in what women could do with a vote, as any other suffragist in the country.
Talk to me about Claiborne Catlin, because she traveled around Massachusetts on horseback and achieved great results as an activist.
Well, I think that Claiborne Catlin is a good example of a seemingly ordinary woman who is driven to do something rather extraordinary, which is to set out all by herself. She's at this point a woman in her early 30s, she's widowed, but she's traveling on her own out at night during the day. She doesn't have any money. She's basically paying her way as she goes on money that is contributed to her. And she was fearless. She even had what I now realize was a kind of Me Too moment on the road where some guy really hit on her and she had to make him back down. So I have great respect for her courage and just the dedication that made her think, this is what I want to do. And again, it's a good story. It tells a good story. And I think it makes people think, wow, you know, she was willing to take 4 months and to, you know, go off on a horse and go through rainstorms and all these things. For the cause of suffrage, she must have really believed in it. And again, that's one of the points that I really hope comes through in my book, is the passion that these women really brought to this cause.
Women did get the vote eventually then in 1920 in the United States, but as you show, the story didn't end there, especially for African-American women.
Yes, that's one of the complications of our upcoming centennial, supposedly celebrating women getting the vote in 1920. Well, not all women got the vote, or they got the right to a vote, but African American women who lived in the South, the U.S. South, were not able to vote because they were subject to the same restrictions that had been placed on African American men after the Civil War, things like literacy tests and poll taxes and all kinds of ways to what we would now call voter suppression to keep them from the polls. And so it really wasn't until 1965, with the passage of a major piece of civil rights legislation called the Voting Rights Act of 1965, that African American women were all finally able to vote. Now, there were African-American women like Ida Wells Barnett, who's another one of my favorites, who lived in Chicago, and African-American women who lived in northern cities could vote, and they are already emerging as political forces, even in the years before the 19th Amendment. But for the vast majority of African-American women who still lived in the South, it was going to be, well, it was really their daughters and granddaughters for whom this would finally become real.
Okay, well, Susan, congratulations on the book and for telling the story so well. It's called Why They Marched, Untold Stories of the Women Who Fought for the Right to Vote. It's published in hardback by Harvard University Press and costs £19.95, so about €23. The author is Susan Ware. And Susan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Silver has influenced 200 years of world history, and it still matters today. A new book tells the story of silver's transformation from soft money during the 19th century to hard asset today, and how manipulations of the white metal by American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt during the 1930s and by the richest man in the world, Texas oil baron Nelson Bunker Hunt during the 1970s, altered the course of American and world history. The book is called The Story of Silver, How the White Metal Shaped America and the Modern World. It's published in hardback by Princeton University Press and costs £24 sterling, so about 27 euro. The author is William L. Silver. And William, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Hi, how are you? It's a pleasure to be here.
We'll start in a later this extraordinary story of Nelson Bunker Hunt, because I'd never heard of him before. And I had never known that he was, for a time, the richest man in the world, and that he lost it all trying to corner the market on silver.
Well, it's hard to believe. And in fact, that's why I wrote the book. Nelson Bunker Hunt died in 2014. And when I told my children, all of whom worked in finance all their lives, that Bunker Hunt died, they said, hey, Dad, is that the fellow in your Sunday golf game that keeps on hitting the ball into the sand? Well, I figured I'm going to have to tell them the story of Bunker Hunt, because he was not a golfer. He was a speculator. And he was, in fact, the richest man in the world in the 1960s. When he owned the drilling rights to oil in Libya, and it was worth about $8 billion, when billions of dollars were really meant something back then.
And why did he become obsessed with silver in the 1970s?
Well, that's part of the story, is that although he was a billionaire several times over because of his oil drilling rights in Libya, when Muammar Gaddafi overthrew the Libyan King Idris, he in fact nationalized all of Bunker Hunt's oil wells in Libya. And what Bunker Hunt worried about was inflation. It was the 1970s, and he had no place to put his money to protect against inflation. If he had oil wells, he wouldn't have worried because the price of oil would have gone up. So he looked for something that would protect against inflation. He didn't trust the U.S. dollar because he said the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, could just print as much of it as it wanted. So he thought about precious metals, and he chose silver.
And is it the case that he and his brother has tried to manipulate the market, and that they ultimately were they committing a crime?
Well, you know, this is a very interesting question. Just by way of background, again, he chose silver rather than gold, which many people would have said would be a better or an equal protection against inflation, because he worried that the central banks of the world had so much gold that the central banks could manipulate its price. So he chose silver because he thought it was a freer market. And he started buying silver in 1973, and he continued to buy silver through the 1970s until 1979, when he really started loading up. And that's because in 1979, the world was worried not only about inflation. Inflation was double digits in the United States. It was 12%. So, too, they were worried about the Iranian hostage taking in the United States Embassy in Iran in November, and the Soviet operation in Afghanistan. And the entire world was buying precious metals, both gold and silver, to protect themselves. So both gold and silver went up. Silver went up twice as much. And that was some of the evidence was that silver went up twice as much as gold. It must have been because of the hunts. The problem is silver always goes up double gold. It is a much more volatile metal. It's a smaller market. It goes up twice as much. So that's not such great evidence that it was manipulated. Everybody was buying precious metals, not just the hunts.
Very interesting. Can we talk about FTR? Because this is an element of FTR's presidency that I wasn't aware of, that he ended up intervening to raise the price of silver, and that this actually had a knock-on effect of helping Japan in its conflict against China.
Well, this is a remarkable story, as you say. I was just as surprised as you were when I was doing the research on this book, to find that FDR, who is one of the greatest presidents the United States had, who pulled the United States out of the Great Depression, but in the process of doing that, he had to kowtow to silver to senators in the United States Senate who came from silver-producing states. And what he did was he agreed to push up the price of silver, make it a monetary metal once again, which it had been at the beginning of the American Republic. And he raised the price of silver by buying it through the U.S. Treasury in order to buy the votes, in a sense, of the senators from the Western mining states in the United States. The problem was China was on the silver standard. Many of the countries of the world were on the gold standard. China was on the silver standard. And what happened was the value of silver went up, which means the yuan went up as well, which discouraged Chinese exports and which created a deflation in China, weakened the Chinese government, and allowed Japanese militarism to overtake China. And this is a consequence of, I hate to put it in modern terms, but I think it's important, America first. FDR was trying to put America first. He ignored the international consequences. And this is a lesson for today. You cannot look just at domestic impacts of a policy without taking into account their international consequences.
Very good. And it's a brilliant book, and it also deals with the role of silver in the 19th century, including William Jennings Bryan's famous Cross of Gold speech, which is probably the most famous or significant speech in American presidential election history, and really central to that debate about gold versus silver.
Yes, the United States was on what we call today a bimetallic standard. When Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, established the dollar as U.S. currency, the U.S. Congress defined it both in terms of gold and silver, and Hamilton wanted enough money in the United States to lubricate economic activity to allow it to grow. But along around the 1870s, when the world started to switch to the gold standard, the United States Congress voted to demonetize silver, to eliminate the silver dollar. And what happened was a huge deflation in the United States. Prices were declining, and that created havoc with the agrarian, with farmers who had mortgages which were fixed in dollar terms, and the value of their farms were declining. This created a huge populist uprising, similar to today. A populist uprising against the bankers who wanted hard currency, and that led to the presidential candidacy of William Jennings Bryan, one of the most famous populists in American history. And in the 1896 presidential election against William McKinley, it was the Goldbugs, McKinley, versus the Silverites, William Jennings Bryan. And he made this great speech called the Cross of Gold speech, which, believe it or not, was all about silver. It was called the Cross of Gold because he said, "Thou shalt not crucify mankind on a cross of gold." Unfortunately for the Silverites, the United States electorate elected McKinley, and William Jennings Bryan then ran two more times, and still he was not elected. Silver was buried as a monetary metal. But the Cross of Gold speech lives on today as an example of Bryan's great oratory, as well as the upheaval in the last quarter of the 19th century in the United States, the populist uprising that put Bryan almost into the White House.
Oh, well, it's an extraordinary story, and you tell it so well in the book and today now on the radio. Thank you so much. It's The Story of Silver, How the White Metal Shaped America and the Modern World, published in hardback by Princeton University Press, costs about €27. The author, William L. Silber. And William, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It was a pleasure, and I hope you enjoyed the book, as well as all your listeners. Thank you for asking me to join you.
Oh, it was our honor. Thank you so much, Bill. We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Father Richard Stanislaus Devane, S.J., was a social advocate and campaigner in the early years of the Irish Free State, yet surprisingly little has been written about him. A new book places Father Richard Devane within the narrative of Irish history of the early 20th century. The book is called Richard Devane, S.J., Social Commentator and Advocate, 1876 to 1951. It's published in paperback by Messenger Publications. The author is Martin Walsh. And Martin, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
And thank you for having me on this show this evening.
Can you tell us about Father Richard Devane then and Catholic Action? Who was he and what was the movement that he got involved with?
Well, Richard Devane was born in Limerick in 1876. He was part of the rising Catholic middle class that emerged at the end of the 19th century. He was primarily concerned after Irish independence that Ireland and the Irish people weren't doing enough to portray themselves as a Catholic country. So Catholic Action had been around for quite a long time at this stage, but he believed that this was a way in which the Irish people could show more devotion to the Catholic Church and at the same time remove all foreign cultural influences from Ireland.
And he seems to have been worried about the influence, the threat of communism.
Yeah, he was particularly worried about communism in the early 1930s. Now, the threat itself was only minute. There wasn't really a big chance of it taking hold here. But he was particularly worried when he saw what was happening in Spain with the destruction of Catholic property and also about 19 Jesuits had been killed in 1936 alone. So he was particularly worried that it could happen here.
So talk to me about some of the threats that he was concerned about. Cinema, for example.
Yes, cinema would have been a lifelong fear of his. He believed that the Irish people shouldn't be sitting in dark halls watching foreign cultural influence, particularly coming from America, and the values that they had, he didn't believe that the Irish people should have. So he was involved in setting up the Irish Film Institute in the early 1940s. Now, unfortunately, in 1945, Archbishop McQuaid quietly shoved him out of that organisation, but it was a concern he had his whole life that Irish people, and in particular young people, were getting their values from outside of Ireland.
And he had concerns about literature as well and believed that that could have a corrupting influence.
Yeah, literature was his one big concern. He had it right from the start of his career as a priest. So when he was first made a curate, he went to Middlesbrough, and it was there that his aversion to British newspapers and books first started. But he was also involved in the start of the campaign to remove immoral literature, which ended with the Censorship of Publication Act in 1929. So that started here in Limerick with the burning of newspapers in late October 1911. And he was particularly concerned about literature, even in his later life, as he was in his early 70s, he was still concerned about immoral literature, believing that after the Second World War, that the threat from foreign publications coming into Ireland, particularly from England, was stronger than ever. And he did his best to try and remove that threat.
And how was he viewed at the time? Was he seen as someone who was maybe too extreme? How was he viewed in the church? Was he again viewed as someone who was articulating a good position, or was it seen as perhaps too hardline?
Initially, he would have been seen as not too hardline. He always had the support of the church. He was particularly friendly with Patrick Lyons, who was a bishop, Patrick Lyons. So he always had the support of the bishops, apart from McQuaid, all his lifetime. But initially, he would have been seen as favourable. So some of the legislation was needed. There was a need for the Censorship of Publications Act. It was the way it was enacted and the way it was used afterwards was a problem. But as he went on in life, people started to question why was he still going on about these issues when the law was there? It was doing its job. But for Devane, he always felt it wasn't enough. And he was always looking for more. So as he went on in life, particularly in the 1940s, people are beginning to question why is he continuing to do this all the time when the legislation is there. And I suppose a good example of that is Miles McLaughlin, who was always trying to question this in the newspapers and trying to basically ridicule Devane for his views.
It's interesting when you work on a figure like Devane, you have to have capable of an act of empathy. You have to be able to put yourself in the position of him at the time and try and understand him in his context.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree with that. And that's what I've done in the book. In the conclusion, I've left it up to the readers. I've presented the facts and let them decide what they think of him. But you absolutely have to think of the situation that was there at the time. Why was Devane so concerned about these issues? If you take it from an international point of view, in Europe, there was a threat that in the 1930s that democratic states were about to fall. He was always fearful that England might come back in and try to take over the country if they weren't seen as being able to govern themselves. He was also trying to show, I believe he was trying to show the Pope as well, that this was a very Catholic country and that we were more Catholic than any other country. So you always have to take it from that period of time.
Very good. Well, the book is called Richard Devane, SJ, Social Commentator and Advocate. It's published in paperback by Messenger Publications, around €25. The author is Martin Walsh. And Martin, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
And thank you as well for having me on the show.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book tells the dramatic but little-known story of a group of prominent Nazi SS hostages who were transported from various concentration camps to a remote Alpine valley in the final days of the Third Reich. Five Irishmen were among the 160 prisoners who Himmler and other SS leaders attempted to use as barter to save the regime or as a final resort themselves. The book is called Dachau to the Dolomites, The Untold Story of the Irishmen, Himmler's Special Prisoners and the End of World War II. The book is published in paperback by Merrion Press and costs €19.95. The author is Tom Wall. And Tom, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks, Patrick.
What I loved about the book is that it's presented in the style of one of those great classic World War II movies where you introduce the cast at the beginning and take us through the extraordinary story, that it is like The Great Escape or it is like one of those great movies.
Well, thanks. In fact, there were a number of former Great Escapers, as you know, who survived the Great Escape. Most of them, of course, were murdered by the Germans, but they ended up with some of the Irish hostages, although very unusual hostages. I mean, none of the Irish could be considered to be of great bargaining chip value to the Germans, but they, for reasons of unusual circumstances, were combined with a lot of celebrity prisoners by the Nazis.
And it also included some of those who'd been involved in the plot to try and blow up Hitler.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah. Remarkably, a number of top German generals were imprisoned with the celebrity prisoners from different countries, but also some of the Stauffenbergs, including the brother of Klaus von Stauffenberg, who had personally placed a bomb beside Hitler in the Wolf's Lair.
Is it true that Stalin's son, he was involved? He was one of them.
He was indeed, yeah. There were two high-value Soviet prisoners. Stalin's son by his first name, Yakov Drugvili, it's hard to pronounce the Georgian names, that which was Stalin's family name. It was his son by his first wife, who died shortly after birth. Yakov never got on with his father very well, but nevertheless, he served in the Soviet army, but was captured early on and ended up in the same hut as four Irish prisoners, ordinary soldiers in the British army. The reasons why they were there are complex, but Stalin's son died not too long afterwards, and after a brawl with some of the Irish prisoners. Now, they weren't directly responsible for his death. It was more than likely a suicide. He threw himself on an electrified fence. But it was after a very nasty bit of fisticuffs with a man called Thomas Cushing in particular.
Talk to me about John McGrath, because in a way he was the inspiration at the start of the book.
He was, yeah. It was an inspiration for me because I visited Dachau just as a tourist about 4 years ago, and I found there was a map with the numbers of prisoners from each country listed on the wall, and one was the figure for Ireland. So I was intrigued about who this might be. And it turned out it was Colonel John McGrath, a Roscommon man, a son of a farmer from near Elphin, who had been a First World War veteran and became, in the interwar period, the manager of the Theatre Royal in Dublin. And he left that job to return to the British Army when called up in 1939.
So tell me about some of the other prisoners, because there's an extraordinary cast of hostages, as you say, Stalin's son, John McGrath, and some mysterious figures as well.
Yeah, I mean, there were people like Leon Blum, the former Prime Minister of France, Kurt Schuschnigg, the Austrian Chancellor before the German takeover. But there were also people I would consider rogues and very unusual hostages, in fact. Some of them probably planted by the SS to be informants within the group to alert the SS to any possible escapes or attacks on the SS as they moved into the Alps and northern Italy.
What happened to the prisoners at the end then? Because it was this attempt to try and either barter them or use them in some kind of negotiations. What happened to them? Was that plan successful?
Well, no. The Germans had been frantically signalling that they had VIP prisoners. They wished to enter into discussions with the British in particular as a prelude to talks on a possible ceasefire on the Western Front. They desperately wanted a ceasefire in order to throw their remaining resources against the Soviets in the east. That was unsuccessful. The British at that stage were not interested at all. Churchill now was in the end interested in trying to retrieve some lost ground from the Soviets, but certainly the Americans would have nothing to do with it. And most of all, Stalin, when he got word that there was some attempt to negotiate with the British and Americans, he went berserk, and Truman, who just became president, called it off.
Okay, well, Tom, it's an extraordinary story. Dachau to the Dolomites, the untold story of the Irishmen, Himmler's special prisoners, and the end of World War II. The book is published in paperback by Merriam Press and costs €19.95. The author, Tom Wall. And Tom, thanks a million for joining us tonight.
Not at all. Thank you, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Stories of the Black and Tans have been told across Ireland since their arrival in 1920. They became the embodiment of British oppression, violence, and malevolence. Tomás McConmara is an award-winning oral historian from County Clare, and in a new book, he has brought together almost two decades of oral history recordings selected from over 400 interviews, as well as access to multiple private family collections. The book is called The Time of the Tans, an oral history of the War of Independence in County Clare. It's published in paperback by Mercier Press and costs €19.99. And Tomás, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks, Patrick.
Tell me about your involvement in oral history, because you've been involved with it for so long, and I think that expertise comes across so strongly in this.
Well, I think it's really critical, you know, in terms of I suppose, sharpening the practice of oral history. It takes time, it takes a lot of experience, because ultimately you're dealing with human beings, with human nature, and to be able to negotiate your way around, you know, people and their memory at private levels, at public levels, at all of that, that takes time, because it's not as simple as understanding how to actually conduct an interview, but you have to understand the memory that's being disclosed to you. So I think it's probably one of the strengths of my work, and one of my advantages is that I started at a very, very young age. You know, I was really interested since I was a child, but I suppose probably from the age of 16, 17, 18, I began to take it much more seriously. And really from the age of 18 or 19, I was, I suppose, to all extents and purposes, a practicing oral historian. So in terms of the material that I've generated from this book, I think it is based obviously on a lot of effort, but obviously, but equally on a lot of experience, which was really required in terms of generating it and understanding it.
What were the things that stood out for you when you were bringing these things together?
Well, really what stood out for me, I think, and from really early on, as I mentioned, from the age of 9 or 10, I was really interested in old people and older things, Patrick, and whatever, you know, could take me to the past, I was interested in it. If that was an artifact or an old person, it didn't matter. But in terms of the War of Independence, from a really young age, I began to hear stories in my own townland in Ballymalone and Tumgraney in East Clare about what happened in my townland. And it struck me, you know, as I got older, that this was a war, you know, as we now know, was, you know, of international significance, but it was played out in my townland. And, you know, people related to me, people related to my neighbours were direct participants. The people surrounding them were drawn into the conflict and drawn into the experience because of the nature of it, because of the reality that the military formations of the IRA were based on existing cultural and geographic boundaries. So it drew that conflict right into the doors and the farms and the fields of local places. So what really stood out for me as I began to kind of make my way through the historiography of the War of Independence when I got older was the gap between what I was reading in the historiography and what I was hearing at a local level. And it wasn't so much on particular evidence or detail. It was more about the way in which the experience of the War of Independence was communicated to me in the memory versus what was being given to me in the literature.
Did people sometimes think that the villains were the black and tans when they may not have been, that they may have been classing all kinds of British forces as black and tans?
It's a really, really good question. And I suppose the title of the book is important in that context, because the title of the book is actually very conscious. I heard that, particularly from people who were children at the time and who grew up immediately afterwards, that was the sort of temporal reference point for the broad experience of the revolutionary period, was the time of the tans. Now, that didn't necessarily mean that those people were categorising all the people involved as tans. That would be the term often used, but I was able to decipher through hundreds of interviews that people were more discerning than you might think with regard to the constituent elements of the British forces. But the tans was an acceptable label, as I can establish, for all the people on the British side. But that does not equate to people understanding that there were auxiliaries, there were black and tans, there were regular British Army, and of course there were RIC involved as well.
How bad were the black and tans in County Clare during the War of Independence?
I don't think there were any worse in County Clare than other parts of the country, but they were particularly violent. But I think I always kind of pull back from that in terms of how the force were assembled, how they were directed, or the lack of direction thereof, that resulted in the behaviour that was manifest during the 15 months or so that they were here. The Black and Tans I see as maybe the age of the axe head, where the people wielding the axe were back in maybe in Westminster and were probably more guilty. But we do focus, and understandably so, on the violence, you know, that was characteristic of the Black and Tans and of the broader British forces. In County Clare, they, in addition to the auxiliaries and some members of the RIC, were responsible for significant violence. Of course, within the memory, you can equally see as well that the IRA were capable and responsible for violence too. And that does come out in the memory and the stories. And that understanding comes out. I want to make that point. It does come out across hundreds of interviews.
A final question. Given that you were dealing with the challenges of memory, was there ever an issue where someone's memory maybe didn't correspond with other evidence or material you had?
of course it does, Patrick. I mean, there's no question. But equally, I would say, I mean, because my history draws in conventional sources, there's plenty of times where I find conventional sources that is immediately contradicted by other evidence as well. So that's the reality of sources. Of course, memory is open to, you know, bias and subjectivity, you know, and the desire for people to remember at in a particular way. But, you know, I think sometimes people focus on that when it comes to memory a little more. The realities of all sources, we need to be cautious with how we use them.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, well, the book is called The Time of the Tans, An Oral History of the War of Independence in County Clare. It's published in paperback by Mercier Press and costs €19.99. The author is Tomás McConmara. And Tomás, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Talking History. On News Talk. Well, welcome back. Now, to end the show tonight, we are going to discuss the paintings of Vermeer. Vermeer's luminous paintings are loved and admired around the world, yet we do not understand how they were made. A brilliant new book by Jane Jelly takes a new path in this detective story as she investigates old secrets and hears travellers' tales. The book is called Traces of Vermeer. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £25 sterling, so about €28. The author is Jane Jelly. And Jane, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's good to be here, Patrick.
Why is Vermeer so loved, and what is it about his paintings that have so entranced and inspired people around the world?
There's something tremendously compelling about them, Patrick. They have a wonderful illumination, and we seem to have a connection with the figures we see in them. And I think that because Vermeer seems to be able to capture a moment in time, it makes us feel we're part of the pictures ourselves. And so we have this extraordinary connection with what is going on in his pictures.
And what's interesting is there are so many mysteries. There are so many questions about how they were made, about what he was working with, how he did it. And you have had to approach this like a detective.
I have, really. I mean, his pictures are very interesting because not only did he use his paint in different ways from his contemporaries, we have discovered underneath the pictures that they look quite different from his contemporaries. There are no drawings as such, which is what you'd expect. There are just only shapes of dark and light. And in order to find out about it, you can take an X-ray and you can have a look underneath, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what decisions a painter would have made. So I went at it from a different point of view. I'm not an art historian. I'm a painter. And I thought, well, if I looked at the materials he had available to him and see how he could use them, maybe I could understand what was going on. Because one of the main questions about Vermeer is whether or not he might have used a lens. And I wanted to find out how he could have done that.
Also, the materials that he used were very different than people would be using today.
Oh, very different indeed. We imagine now a painter with a huge, big palette, and he can go into an art shop and get lots of paint tubes off the shelf, squeeze them on the palette, and off he goes. Bob's your uncle. But in the time Vermeer was painting, there were not very many colours available, and they were not mixed up as paint. You had to grind your paint to start with. And also, the other big problem was a lot of these pigments reacted with each other. So you couldn't just mix them up at all. You had to use them in layers and be very careful to separate them from each other because they might blister or fade or flake or turn black. And that would be useless if you wanted to sell a picture.
And it's interesting you mentioned there about the possibility of using a lens, because some of his paintings are out of focus, the way he uses light. It's very interesting that he may have been using some of the things that were new technology at the time.
Absolutely. Brand new technology. But there were people using telescopes at the time and people had glasses, you know, for reading. But it's a very interesting thing to think that Vermeer could have used a lens. And one of the reasons people think that is that there is evidence, there seems to be optical evidence actually painted into his pictures. But the problem is, it's quite difficult to use a lens. You have to paint in the dark, and the image you might see projected on a wall with a lens isn't the right way up. And so those are two big technical problems.
So what have you discovered? You've discovered that it's possible he was having projections on the wall?
You want to have something the right way up and the right way round, because you want to be able to compare it with what is in your studio in the light. You want to be able to paint in the light. And you can't paint in the light. You can't paint in colour in the dark in a camera obscura. So what do you do? How do you make it the right way round? And I realised that it's a printing reversal, and that if you could trace on something in the camera obscura, on something you could take out and then turn over and print onto a blank canvas, you get an under image that was the right way round and the right way up. And Vermeer could use that image made in a dark paint. He could use it as an underpainting in his pictures.
So you may have discovered the secret to Vermeer's genius, and the secret to why some of the paintings are a bit fuzzy.
Yes, they're fuzzy, and they are slightly out of focus, some of them. There are some strange differences in scale, which are very photographic. It's like getting very close with your camera and doing a bit of a panoramic view. You see things that are very close to you are much bigger, and we see that in Vermeer's pictures. And we see in his pictures, as often on the left-hand side, there is a darkness. And maybe he put his lens down there on the left-hand side to stop the fogging of the lens. I think I might have discovered the way he could have transferred an image from a camera obscura. And the most exciting thing is that when I made my prints, they look very, very like the underpaintings we can actually see in Vermeer's pictures using scientific investigation.
And the best bit of all is that it encourages us to go back to the works and look at them with fresh eyes.
I think so. I think the big argument has always been that, you know, if Vermeer used the lens, was he still a genius? And I have to say he absolutely was, because his idea of composition is extraordinary and his colour is amazing. Neither of those things have anything to do with the lens. What they're to do with is his genius. And so because there have been all these awful arguments, people being very cross either side of this argument, could he have used a lens, could he not? It has got in the way, really, of somebody finding out, just practically finding out, whether it was possible or not.
Well, Jane, congratulations on an extraordinary piece of detective work. The book is called Traces of Vermeer. It's published in hardback and now available in paperback as well by Oxford University Press. In paperback, it costs £12.99 sterling, so about €15. The author is Jane Jelly. And Jane, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Calvin, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we'll be exploring the concept of liberty in the work of the political theorist John Stuart Mill as we look back on one of my favourite shows of the year. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.